Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to welcome Kevin Houchin, an attorney, artist, teacher, and principal of Houchin & Associates, a copyright, trademark, arts and entertainment, business development, and branding firm located in Fort Collins, Colorado. Kevin's newest book is called Fuel the Spark, Five Guiding Values for Success in Law School and Beyond. Welcome, Kevin.
Hello.
Kevin, I loved your book, and I've never been to law school, so that's weird, but maybe you can tell our listeners what the book is about and then how it applies to people in any kind of a learning situation.
I'd love to. Well, the book is about some soft skills that a lot of us don't get taught in our normal education life, and I thought that especially in the law school experience, those soft skills being integrated into your lifestyle and having a reminder that you control your life would be very, very valuable. And the law school market is something that I know. And so rather than diving in and competing with the likes of Wayne Dyer and all those other wonderful self-help people, I would just focus on a niche that I knew and provide some value there and see where it went after that.
Cool. So I was really intrigued when I read the book to hear that you went to law school at age 33 after you had some life and work experience. So I'm wondering how that made law school a better experience for you.
Well, law school is a tough time in especially a young person's life, because basically what you're learning is you're reading what are called case summaries that are basically the truth is stranger than fiction stories of problems people have gotten in through the decisions they make in life. And if you are so young that you really haven't had a chance to make your own mistakes and learn from them, then learning life out of a casebook can be a very, very challenging and disheartening time, because everything is taken in the abstract. But if you've had a dozen years or so under your belt, like I did, to, be hired and fired from jobs, to, my ex-wife had been in a car accident, so we'd been through some of those kind of things. I negotiated as a sales and marketing consultant literally hundreds of contracts, so I knew what was going on there. From a branding perspective, I'd launched a lot of companies, a lot of businesses, so I knew how a lot of the legal issues worked relative to those things. I bought and sold houses and done different things like that in my life. So when I was reading cases of basically those situations that have gone bad and how the law resolved them, I was going, okay, now that makes sense. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, that makes sense. Here was this, kind of in hindsight, here was the stupid decision that somebody made at one point or another that got themselves into this situation. Or was it a stupid decision? Was it just something where circumstances brought them into a situation where the only resolve they, recourse they had was legal? And so when you have that kind of context, it's a lot easier to understand what's going on in the casebooks. And so you're not getting, you're not getting a 1-2 punch. There's still a lot of stuff you've got to learn and a lot of rules you have to learn, but you have a context with which, in which to put them. And if you're only 21, 22, coming straight out of your undergraduate institution, those are still abstract concepts, and it makes it a lot more difficult for those younger people.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I kind of approached it, when I read it, I thought, well, obviously you do better because you have better time management, you kind of know life, but it's really because of that life experience.
Yeah, the time management, we're all still struggling with that. So
yeah.
I don't know if I do have some stuff in the book to hopefully help the younger law students figure out what's going on, and the, the older law students to remember that their value and their experience is definitely worth something in that classroom. But the cool thing about the book and what I'm most proud of is that when a lot of people such as yourself read it that have no law background, no goals in going to law school or anything, they say, you take law school out of this and it still applies to me.
Yeah.
And the reason I think that happened is, if you don't mind, I'll tell a little bit about how the book came together.
Sure.
I had a professional coaching relationship going on, just as a general business coaching relationship, with a wonderful coach here in Fort Collins. And at the end of our year contract, she gave me what is probably one of the most beneficial gifts anybody has ever given me in my life, and it wasn't a trinket or a coffee cup. It was a list of the things that over the course of the year she'd been keeping for me, that was a list of the things that I was doing when I was doing my best. Okay? And so she is an objective observer at 100,000 feet, could look at it and say, you know what? When Kevin's doing great when he's in here in a session and is really up and pumped about something, it's because of X, Y, and Z.
Wow.
And she gave me that list, and the next day I had a chance to drive for about 4 hours to a conference that I was going to speak at. And over that 4 hours, I basically had time to meditate on that list and to let that sink into me and mull it around in my brain. And when I got to the conference hotel, I still had 2 or 3 hours before the first session that I had to be at. And in that 2 or 3 hours, I specifically chose to leave the TV off, and I sat down and I pounded out about a 15-page essay that was at that time called Five Winning Principles, because that's how she had put it on the list. These are the, you know, these are the winning principles. And there were more on the list, but I could consolidate them under five headings. And so I wrote that essay, basically channeled that essay in about 3 hours, because I had a deadline because I wanted to get it done before I left and while it was still fresh in my brain. And so my first draft just poured out of me in that time. And I went back to it the next week and just kind of refined it a little bit. And then I just put it out there as a little essay that I gave to friends and, you know, just asking for feedback. And people were reading it and sharing it on airplanes. And it was kind of getting some, you know, I was getting nice feedback on it. And then people said, you know, you really should do something with this more than just share it as an essay. And so I thought, well, you know, it's pretty short to be a full book and everything, just as the essay. So why don't I expand on it and make it applicable, you know, to more people? And again, the choice on being a new author was, do you try and make a splash in something that is general mass market, or do you really find a niche that you know, define it in there, and then add the stories and examples and practical application aspects to this, you know, what was basically just a long essay, and make it into a small book? And
yeah,
that's the way I chose to do this.
So, you know, in the book you talk about the importance of showing up and paying attention, or 100% attention. So how did you show up and pay attention to kind of expand the book into what it is from that shorter essay?
Well, one, I had a goal I wanted to reach. I really wanted to have a publishable book, and I really wanted to have something that could help the audience.
Huh.
And, you know, and share it with as many people as I can. So that was a motivation to get it done. The way I show up and pay attention in my own life, especially when I try to sit down and write, is I have to, you know, not turn on a TV. You know, I'm a big fan of Twitter and Facebook, and I have to keep myself to have those windows closed. A lot of times I put on headphones specifically, you know, like the Holosync meditation-type headphones to keep me focused and in the moment and get my ego, get my monkey brain shut off and out of the way so that I can just get out of the way of the words.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love this quote you had in the book, which was, the breakthrough for me was understanding that I can surrender my anxiety without giving up my goals. Because I think a lot of writers get so anxious about what they're doing or all they have to do that they just give up their goals.
Yeah, I am not a surrender kind of guy, and surrender was a word that kept coming up during that course of that coaching relationship. And you know, I'm one of those people that give and give and give and give and give. And, you know, I was a Iowa wrestler. You know, you're in Wisconsin, correct?
Yeah, so I get the Iowa thing.
You get the Iowa thing. And I was a small kid in school, and so wrestling was really the only time I had a fair chance.
Yep.
And I got started in, like, second grade, and I can still remember Coach Dan Stevens saying, you never surrender, you never get up, you don't even sleep on your back.
Wow.
You know, and that kind of stuff. And so that's the attitude that I brought to my life all the way through until the surrender just kept coming up and coming up and coming up. And finally, as lawyers tend to do, we go to the dictionary and we say, there's got to be something else in here. And so one of the things is that, you know, in the wrestling form of the word surrender, it's capitulate. You know, it's roll over and die. But surrender means more than that. It also means to just let go of. And so when that happened to me and I said, oh my God, that's what surrender, you know, so it's like, just let go of all that crap you're worried about, you know, let go of not being good enough, let go of, you know, trying to come out and help as many people as Wayne Dyer has in your first book, you know, I mean, let go of all that stuff, because if you try to be, you know, you combine that with a little bit of, you know, pop culture. I like the movie Tin Cup because there are some great quotes in that, but one of them is perfection is unattainable. And that, you know, is why golf is such a challenging and frustrating and lovely sport. Perfection is unattainable. And writing perfection is unattainable as well. And, you know, the day that one of my books or anything that I ever do comes out without a typo in it, I will probably keel over and die. But, you know, that's craft and writing is art. So anyway, but another thing is a little bit is better than nada. So, you know, getting it out, getting it down, the first draft to me is always the toughest because that's where I've got to shut off the critic. I've got to let it get out and know that getting something down on paper is better than nothing down on paper. Getting something out and the whole fact that, you know, everybody has a book in them, but very, very few people let it out. You know, just by the sheer act of getting it out, you're ahead of 99% of the other people that want to do a book.
Yeah, that's true. You know, you told this interesting story in the book about taking your second bar exam. You'd passed in one state. You took your bar exam in the second state, and you actually improved your score by taking a break every half hour. So tell me about that and what you think that was about.
Well, I think that was about one. You know, you're the first time you take a thing that, you know, literally has the chance to change your life, and a bar exam is one of those things. Because if you don't pass it, you are not licensed to practice for another 6 months, and you've got to take it again, you know, and everything. So the first time you sit for a bar exam or the first time you sit for any kind of licensing exam, you're pretty nervous. And there is a lot of anxiety that goes into that. And you know what to expect because there's no secrets in it, but you haven't done it before.
Yeah.
And you don't know you're good enough. You know, so you tell yourself you are, of course, but until the results come back, you're not. And so after, you know, the second time around when I took another bar exam, which is basically the same thing with different questions, I knew that I could do it. That was one. Second is I knew that I'd passed it before with plenty of room. And so I didn't have to be, you know, I could go into it in a lot more calm knowledge. And so when I did that, I knew a lot better of how to manage myself. I knew not to second-guess myself. And I knew that if I got up, because I am probably borderline ADHD, and so it is really hard for me to concentrate on things for more than a half hour at a time. And so I said, okay, every half hour I am going to, for better or worse, get up and go to the restroom and splash some cold water on my face and refocus and come back and spend, you know, 3 or 4 minutes doing that because you're the only one in the bathroom during a bar exam because nobody else is taking that
time. Nobody else does that.
Yeah, and so I did that, and actually I still got done with certain segments of it that were tough, you know, with a good 5 minutes to spare, which is everything, you know, in those kind of three-hour blocks. And I felt good about it, and I was calm, and, you know, I was still drained at the end of the day, but I wasn't wiped out. So, you know, so I was able to really focus a lot more on the time that I was there, and my brain was not hopping off into different planes of consciousness. And so I think that that's part of it, too, is that when you've done something once, I mean, the first time it's always going to be hard to get through the anxiety. There's no way around that. That's part of life. That's part of expanding your boundaries. But the next time you do something, it's going to be easier, and you're going to do better at it, and you can better manage yourself. And then the third time, it's even better. Fourth time, you know, it becomes rote, and that's when you need to start looking at how can I expand my comfort zone again.
So now it sounds like you, at least from reading the book, it sounds like you've taken the strategy of working in half-hour chunks and made it part of your life strategy.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I can, I do that, and that's just knowing me. You know, for me, I can do almost anything in a half an hour. or at least I can segment it into that. I mean, there are meetings where I've got clients and, you know, we're discussing how to form a new company and how the relationship's going to work and what those details are. And sometimes in those meetings, I can look up and an hour and 15 minutes will have disappeared because we were so into it and time just didn't matter. Other times, if there's stuff going on where I'm, you know, finding my mind wandering, then I will say it's time for us to take a break and refill people's coffee and do those kind of things so that I can use that bar exam technique again of just getting up, refocusing, looking out the window, and then coming back in and reframing questions and getting things moving again. So it is a technique that I use a lot of the time.
To kind of re-energize and
refocuses, because we can all get into a groupthink situation. We can all, you know, we've all been in meetings where somebody's rambling on. Somebody might be listening to the call and saying, I'm rambling on right now. In which case, hit pause. Get up, go get a fresh cup of coffee and come back. So,
well, thinking about groupthink, you talked about mastermind groups. And, you know, tell me what a mastermind group is like for you and how they've supported you.
Well, a mastermind group is basically peer mentoring in my definition of it. And the way they've worked for me is that once you can get out of the inherent arrogance that asking questions and showing that you don't know everything is going to hurt you, once you have a set of trusted advisors that you can talk to on those kind of different situations, then you get that feedback and you have that support network and you've got people that, one, are asking you questions to help them, which always makes you feel good, and two, are people that you can trust to ask questions of to help you figure out something. And it's really, you know, if you can provide that value back and forth, you don't have to feel like you're intruding on anybody, and you don't have to feel like when you ask them a favor that it's going to come back and bite you.
Yeah.
And so that's really where it comes from. And then you get a lot of ideas from people that just spark, and that's wonderful stuff.
Well, that's great. Now, I know you work with branding. So how do you see branding working for authors or writers?
It depends on the niche that you want to be in. I don't write fiction. So in the work that I'm doing is more nonfiction, business niche, those kind of things. In those areas, the branding is all about setting yourself up as an expert in that niche. You know, why should people listen to you? What kind of value do you provide? What kind of experience do you have? And so the branding on all of those things is relative to usually your name, and maybe a theme that you tend to work around, or a niche that you tend to work around, or a line of books that you have. You know, like Rick Frischman has Author 101, you know, those series. Jeffrey Gittimer in the sales end of things has the little red book, the little yellow book, the little gold book, you know, those kind of things. And so those branding themes really become a trademark of the author. But for most people, it's their name, you know, and that's the main thing. When you get into the fiction type works, and I'm a big fan of science fiction and fantasy, then it may be a brand around a character. You know, the Dirk Pitt novels, pretty much it usually becomes a character in series fiction. But you might find other brands. I can't think of any that are jumping off the
Well,
the
I think
track,
in mysteries, you'll have brands that grow up around kind of tiny genres, like knitting mysteries or bed and breakfast mysteries or...
Yeah, but those are categories.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between the category and the brand.
Okay.
Okay, because
so
the brand
more about
is
that.
An indicator of source. And this is my trademark lawyer coming out.
Okay.
Because, and this is why I became a lawyer, is because the business of creativity is going to be my next book. It's going to be
good.
Called The Secrets of Creative Business. But one of the key things to differentiate in there is that trademark law is only protecting the goodwill that you've put into becoming the source of a good or service.
Yeah.
So if there's only one book out there that is by that title, that's not trademarkable. But if you're doing lectures around that, or workshops, or you've got a workbook and a trade release book and different things like that coming out, or a series of audio CDs, and they're all around this, the title. Then you've got something where that whole thing becomes something that is an indicator of you as the source of those goods or services, and that is something that we can protect via trademark law. So, like Alex Brown for, detective novels, if it was just one book, that's not enough. But if we've got a series of them, then that comes into play, Dirk Pitt being another one, and there are a bunch of, different female characters, especially in the mystery novels, and now in the horror/goth mystery vampire type stuff. Those characters that are, I think it's Laura Hamilton that has a series that her main character is now, trademarkable. We know that it's an X and such story. And so it's that kind of thing of once you build up a recognition around a character, usually a character in fiction, and your own self in nonfiction, is where you really start developing some brand strategy.
That's fascinating. I never knew that, Kevin. Thank you.
Well, there you go. Free legal advice. You didn't expect to get that, did you?
Well, I think I never knew you could trademark a character, and I think our listeners will be really interested in that.
Yeah, definitely. And you'll want to. I can't go write a Luke Skywalker adventure without getting George Lucas's permission and paying him a licensing fee for the use of that character.
Yep. So do you have a final tip you'd like to leave with our listeners from any part of your expertise?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you two.
Okay.
One, as a writer, just get it on paper. Get yourself out of the way. That's the biggest challenge. Find a way to get yourself out of the way and just let the words come through you. And then as a lawyer, the number one thing that you want to do is when you've got a manuscript or a draft of a manuscript, before you share it with anybody that could use it without your permission, i.e. don't send it to a publisher, don't send it to an agent, don't send it to anybody like that, until you have gone to copyright.gov and sent in a $45 registration fee along with a 2-page form to register the copyright on your work. And the reason for that, and this is the lawyer speaking, is that even though copyright vests at the moment that you write something down, if you have not registered it and you call me up and you say somebody ripped me off, all that's on the table are what we call actual damages.
Hmm.
And actual damages are hard to prove and for most people will not even cover the legal fee. And so in that situation, there's a righteous beef, but the economic justification in going after and enforcing the righteous beef is a completely separate thing. And you end up just having to, watch somebody use your creative material without your permission, and it really makes no economic sense to try and stop them. If you have, before that infringement happened, before somebody used it without your permission, if you have sent in the copyright registration, that $45 fee and 2-page form, that's really easy to do and everybody can do it, then if somebody rips off your work, what's on the table are what we call statutory damages, which we don't have to prove, and those are anywhere from $750,000 to $150,000 per infringement. The other thing that's on the table is attorney's fees. And so if you have registered something and you call me up and say somebody ripped off my work, then when I send the cease and desist letter and demand payment, I'm also going to be able to demand enough to cover your legal fees out of that, and that cease and desist letter has way more teeth than if you haven't registered your copyright. So consider registration of your copyright to be the best insurance policy for creative people on the face of the planet, and the premium for that insurance is only $45 for your entire lifetime. So, per work, of course. But anyway, do that. If you have any questions on that, again, copyright.gov has some great resources. They have plenty of brochures to walk you step-by-step through that. And if you'd like to know more about that, you can go to my website at www.houchinlaw, which is houchinlaw.com. And if you go to the January 2009 set of blog posts, there is a link to a hour-long or a little bit over an hour a webinar that's free with a bunch of slides and my voiceover on a conference call for authors specifically that you can, you know, happily listen to for free. And if you have any questions after that, you're welcome to email me, and you can do that via my site, or you can send me a Twitter at Kevin Houchin, and I'll be happy to engage.
That sounds great, Kevin. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. I really appreciate being on, and I like the work that you're doing, and keep it up.
Thank you. Same to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
This has been another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. You can find a link to Kevin's website and his new book at my website, rightnowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.